This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Introducing Batiste Sweat-Activated and Touch-Activated Dry Shampoo. With breakthrough technology that absorbs oil and releases bursts of fragrance whenever you sweat or touch your hair for up to 24 hours, it's the ultimate hair care for girls on the go. Try the newest dry shampoo that's activated by you. Batiste, the future of hair care is here. Buy Batiste Dry Shampoo online or in store at your nearest retailer.
Next on Book TV's Afterwards, American University professor Ibram Kendi argues that America must choose to be anti-racist and work towards building a more equitable society. He's interviewed by Imani Perry, author and Princeton University African American Studies professor. Afterwards is a weekly interview program with relevant guest hosts interviewing top nonfiction authors about their latest work.
Ibram, it is wonderful to be here with you to talk about this extraordinary book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. And I have so many questions, but the first one is, why this book now?
Well, of course, I'm just excited to sit down and talk to you about this book, Imani. And I mean, the reason is because I feel like the people asked for it. You know, my last book, which was a history of racist ideas, yes, stemmed from the beginning. I also chronicled the history of anti-racist ideas.
Right.
And really sort of showed their collision, their clash, the debate between them over time. And so when I would speak about that book, I would encourage people to be anti-racist. I would encourage them to sort of move away from the racist ideas that have been ingrained in them. And so the more I spoke about being an anti-racist, the more people were like, okay, tell me a little bit more about that anti-racism stuff. Because, as you know, people are taught in this country to be not racist.
Right.
And so this construct of being anti-racist was new. So the more people asked how to be an anti-racist, the more I realized that this was a book. And I felt like I could potentially answer it.
So that's really interesting because it sounds as though you hadn't necessarily planned to write this book, right? And I was thinking, because Stamped from the Beginning is an extraordinary book. You are a historian through and through, and there is a kind of risk associated with writing a book that has like really immediate implications,
yes,
right? But you felt called to do this, and talk about the distinction, though, but that you draw, because you draw it in a very kind of clear and cogent fashion. One of the things I noticed is that so many of the authors of like concurrent books on race that are considered really kind of critical have all written this extraordinary praise of this book, which is an indication of how important it is, right? That the people who have thought deeply about race say, yes, we need this book. So what's that distinction? What's the distinction between just being not racist and anti-racist, and why is that so important?
Well, I think first and foremost, let's think about how this term not racist is emerging currently, and
right,
how has it emerged historically. And so people typically say, I'm not racist, when what? When they're charged with
right,
being racist.
As a defensive gesture, right.
Precisely.
Right.
And I don't think even well-meaning people, even people who are trying to be part of the movement against racism, recognize really that the history of this term. So when a eugenicist were classified as racist, they said, I'm not racist. When Jim Crow segregationists were charged with being racist, they said, I'm not racist. Mm-hmm. And now today, even white nationalists
right,
are saying, I'm not racist,
right,
no matter whether they're in the White House or, you know, planning the next mass shooting. And so I don't think people realize how much fundamentally this has been a term of denial, that that has really all I've been able to really uncover of its meaning
right,
has been this sort of way to deny, and you know, one's own racism. While anti-racist has a clear philosophy. It has a clear history, just mm-hmm. as racist has a clear philosophy and a clear history.
Right. So what I think is really interesting and powerful about that move is that it gets the reader and the potential sort of person operating in community shaped by this book out of the question of sort of guilt, right?
Yeah.
So the point isn't really whether or not you personally are a racist. The point is, what are you doing about mm-hmm. how racism pervades every possible aspect of life in
yes.
this nation, right?
Precisely. And I think that's, I think many people say they are not racist
mm-hmm.
because they think racist is like a tattoo. That they,
right.
That if they say they're racist, they'll put somebody will put a racist on their forehead. They'll never be able to escape it.
Right.
They think it is a fixed category.
Mm-hmm.
They believe it is a fundamentally a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
They believe a racist is a person who is hooded, who's
right.
a white nationalist,
right?
Right, who is a segregationist.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, I'm not in any of those things. I'm a good person.
Right.
I'm against the Klan. I'm not racist.
Right.
But it's a descriptive term,
mm-hmm.
right? And it describes what a person is doing in the moment. And so
right.
when a person is saying that a particular racial group is inferior, they're being a racist. When a person is
right.
doing nothing
mm-hmm.
in the face of racial inequity, they're being racist. When a person is literally supporting persons and policies and power that is creating and reproducing racial inequity and injustice, they're being racist.
Right. So that's important too, right? Because you're getting the category racist out of this question of sort of a kind of the personal indictment and making this claim. And you say that beautifully in the book, that this is descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm offering an account of behaviors that
yeah.
are part of the processes of inequality, so stop being so emotionally invested
yeah.
in this term, right? Essentially,
yeah.
is what you're saying, right?
Precisely. And I think that emotional investment and people feeling like they're being attacked.
Right.
Also, I think people don't realize the origins of that.
Like mm-hmm.
the origins of the idea that racist is like the R word
right,
compared
right,
to the N word.
Right. Oh, right.
That
it's the worst insults.
Precisely.
Right.
That
worse
it's a racial
racist,
slur.
Right.
That it is a pejorative.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, actually, white nationalists in particular have been parroting that idea for decades. Because what they wanted to do is they
so
wanted particularly to get mm-hmm. white people to not recognize their racism. And if they don't recognize their own racist ideas, then white nationalists will be able to easily organize them.
Right.
And to give an example, Richard Spencer, 2 years ago, who organized the Unite the White rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, which led to, of course, the violence and the death of Heather mm-hmm. Heyer, he once said, as I talk about in the book, that racist isn't a descriptive term. It's a pejorative term.
Mm.
It's the equivalent of someone saying, I don't like you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Right. So this is an important thing to confront. And I think,
yeah.
Just shifting gears, and I want to come back to that question and actually to think about if you can offer an account of what it means to be anti-racist
yeah.
in its detail. But
yeah.
but also, so what one of the things that I think you do quite powerfully in this book, and there are a number of elements, but is that so you know the title is it gives an indication of a kind of instruction that you're offering that has personal implications.
Definitely.
Right? So how do you discern how you operate in the world in a way, whether or not you're actually sort of participating in the structural logic, in the processes of racism, or you're actually working to dismantle them.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, so there's this personal element, but at the same time, you talk about structural issues, you talk about gender, you talk about sexuality, you talk about capitalism, all these sorts of things. And so I think it's really powerful and important, and I want to ask you, why, and this is also in light of Stamped, right?
Yeah.
In the midst of you having this sort of deep account of the structure and history of white supremacist thought and power, that you decided to talk to people at their interior level?
Yeah, so I didn't want to write this book this way.
Okay.
And when I say this way, I did not want to speak to people through my own personal story.
Mm-hmm.
Because as an historian, as a scholar, this is not the way we're sort of trained, as you know,
right, yeah.
to sort of communicate scholarship or even communicate ideas. And so that was, I was deeply hesitant. And then I'm deeply personal and private.
Right.
And so to really put some of the most shameful moments of my life on the page for all the world to see was obviously very, very difficult for me to do. But at the same time, these ideas and structures and policies and powers at its core are impacting people, are impacting individuals. And individuals are either part of the forces that are challenging racist power or unknowingly or knowingly supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
And so fundamentally, because of that impact and because each of us are supporting or opposing racism, you know, ultimately, I wanted to sort of show that.
Right.
And how that operates on a sort of day-to-day basis.
Right.
How that operates conceptually and even all of the complexities within that. And in my case, you know, for most of my life, I was actually supporting and opposing
yes.
racism or white supremacy without even knowing it.
Right.
And so I thought the best way to do that was through my own personal story.
Yeah. So, and I want to talk more about that because maybe it's good to start with. I want to talk about your personal journey, but to start with what I think will probably be the source of most of the pushback you get about the book, which I think is a really important argument that you make, which is one that Black people can be racist, and you talk about it in several different ways,
yeah.
right? And so one way that you talk about it is actually the ways in which Black people can adopt white supremacist ideologies vis-a-vis Black folks, and also vis-a-vis other people of color, and also so the relationship to sort of white racism as a sort of large-scale phenomenon and the encounter with the individual who might be anti-racist. So can you just talk about both why you thought that was important to include and just what it means, right?
Yeah. So I obviously for a very long time thought Black people could not be racist. and I would have argued people
down, right?
People down for anyone who made that case. And I don't think it was, I believed that until I started researching for Stamp from the beginning.
Okay.
And until I conceptualized, I first defined a racist idea.
Yeah.
And I defined it as any idea that suggests a racial group is inferior or superior to another in any way. And then that book was about anti-Black racist ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I went in search. And ultimately, one of the things I tried to do with that book was sort of take prevalent and prominent and popular ideas today and really sort of figure out its intellectual sort of genealogy.
Right.
What was unavoidably the case was that Black intellectuals were part of that intellectual genealogy.
Right.
And I couldn't, even though I wanted to like exclude them or go around them, I just couldn't. You take the case of one of the most dominant and harmful anti-Black racist ideas of the 20th century was the idea of the broken Black family and the patriarchal Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
I should say matriarchal, who was harming the Black family and the Black community and so on and so forth. That idea, of course, was popularized by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, as you know. But in his Moynihan report in 1965, he repeatedly cited a Black scholar, an E. Franklin Frazier, who wrote the famous book on the Negro family in 1939, who also praised Du Bois, who said a similar thing in one of his Black family studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could not wrap my head around the fact that this idea about the broken Black family was largely coined by a Black scholar.
Right.
And I think everybody now recognizes how harmful that idea is, how it sort of justified the assault on welfare, how it justified the assault on Black women, how it justified so many assaults in the latter part of the 20th century. And so ultimately I'm saying that I think that was the first recognition of it. that you I could not separate the intellectual genealogy of some of these ideas. But I think what was critical was realizing what racist ideas do to people. And I realized that no matter the racial group, when a person was anti-black, when a person thought that there was something wrong with black people, they spent their time intellectually and even in terms of organizations either trying to civilize black people, attack black people, attack everything but the real problem, which was racism, which was white supremacy. And so that's how it literally functioned, right? And that's on the ideological perspective. And then obviously when it came to like power and policy, I think that it is absolutely the case that black people have limited amounts of power vis-a-vis white people, particularly within a white supremacist society. But to say that no black people have no power.
It's just not true.
It's just not true. And and to also say that even 100 years ago, when we did not have all of these black elected officials, when we did not have a black person on the Supreme Court, when we did not have so many black professors and so on and so forth, we all still had the power to resist. And some of us used that power, and some of us did not. And typically those who did not because they thought the problem was black people. And so, you know, it was sort of working through all of that that ultimately caused me to realize that black people can be racist too, particularly to black people. And that ultimately internalized racism was the real black-on-black crime.
That's beautifully stated. You you tell this story about a speech that you gave as an adolescent. And you deconstruct it for precisely that, right? The kind of internalization of a narrative of black deficiency, right, or inadequacy. And I think it's so powerful in part because the rhetorical devices that you describe are actually quite common in kind of black public spheres, right? So you're calling into question, you know, that practice, which is a real, I mean, a long-standing, widespread practice. And I wonder, this is kind of just a question that's a little bit off to the edge, but I think it's interesting is, you know, why do you think that has such persistence, even as I think, you know, I agree. I think most of us black people think that we are anti-racist in some form or another. And yet we listen and we nod and we applaud to these kinds of lectures, whether they come from Chris Rock and or a pastor, right?
I mean, I think it's a combination of factors. I think first and foremost, I mean, this speech that I gave when I was a senior in high school, and it was at a Martin Luther King oratorical contest, and I was one of the finalists. So in other words, I had won my school competition, and I was one of the three finalists across the county, and I spoke before 3,000 mainly black people. And basically my speech was a litany of anti-black ideas, particularly about black youth. And so I said things like, black youth are the most feared in society, as if it was their fault they were so feared. I said things like black youth don't value education, which was a very prominent idea.
It still has currency.
Precisely. That black youth keep climbing this high tree of pregnancy. That all of these ideas about what was wrong with black youth, and ironically, as you know, if there was ever a decade in which seemingly everyone was coming down on the heads of black youth, it was the 1990s. And that's the decade in which I came of age, and I consumed those ideas and reproduced them. And, you know, to your question, I think it's a combination of that across the ideological board, it is acceptable to say those ideas. So, you know, I thought I was radical when I was saying that. And so obviously black conservatives will say that. I think they say it in a different type of way.
It has a different valence, but
precisely. And I also, you know, realized through some other work that I think not only in terms of the ideological popularity, but ultimately black people regularly see individual black negativity. And mm-hmm. and what we have been led to believe is that we can generalize that.
We read that as it, right.
Precisely. Right. So everything we say, I mean, we know youth that are feared because of what they're doing. We know youth that don't value education, mm-hmm. right? And so because we know individuals like that, right. we just assume that is part of the problem. Not sometimes realizing that there are white youth who don't value education.
Absolutely.
There are right. white youth who are extremely violent. Mm-hmm. And not realizing, and I think I'll, let me just say, I think one of the things I've tried to emphasize mm-hmm. is what makes black people equal to other racial groups is not our sort of great black people and our great attributes, it's our imperfections.
Right, we're human, we're fully human. Right.
Precisely.
And I, you know, I think connected to what you're just saying is there's also the piece that you talk about with respect to class that's really important, right? Because all of those things that you describe, right? We know youth who don't value education, there are kids who are violent, that's not an accounting that you can give of poor and working class black kids. That's across the economic spectrum, right? So so it's also sort of you're challenging what in many arenas is accepted as gospel, right? Even from kind of liberal perspective where people feel sorry for certain because of a lack of opportunity, but still traffic in these ideas of kind of something being deficient, right?
Precisely. And I think I was trying to really anchor the book mm-hmm. in a way on this class perspective by making the case, and I should say by showing how I was largely raised in a black middle income home mm-hmm. and the new black middle class of the 1980s understood themselves as a distinct racial group
right.
that was distinct from black poor people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that in my parents were taught and to a certain extent believed that they were members of the black middle class because of their own hard work
right.
and ingenuity,
right.
which meant that people were still poor because they weren't working
right,
hard.
Right.
And when we think of like racial groups and racial disparities and racial distinctions, we don't think intra-racial distinctions.
Right.
We don't think about how there is a such thing as white trash
right. mm-hmm.
that white elites have created to substantiate their beliefs in their own white superiority. Because
right.
we have to say that those...
They must be some other group.
Precisely.
Right. Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. And so I think that class is absolutely sort of critical in understanding the way race sort of operates. And I think that when we speak about being anti-racist, it's not just saying sort of black elites are equal to white elites. It's black elites recognizing that there's nothing wrong with black poor people.
Right.
And that all they need is resources and opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And I also say that I think one of the most difficult things for people to realize, and it took me a while to accept this, is this idea that oppressive conditions literally are not just dehumanizing, but they actually make people into subhumans.
Right.
That poverty literally depresses the behavioral and cultural sort of attributes of mm-hmm. black people.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
they are acting behaviorally deficient because they're poor.
Mm-hmm.
And what we don't realize is black elites, like white people and like other people, are creating their own standard of how people should act.
Right.
Assessing poor blacks from that standard
right.
and saying, oh, they're not reaching this standard because they're poor.
Right, right. When in fact, sometimes the behaviors that are seen as deficient are in fact logical and
yeah.
actually and mechanisms for survival.
Precisely.
Or resource, accessing resources that are necessary when you have very limited resources. Right,
exactly.
yeah, right. And that speaks to, I mean, one, I love the way that you tell the story of your folks as a kind of movement, social movement history story
mm-hmm.
too, because,
yeah.
I mean, one of the things that we miss in the public discourse is sort of what happens after civil rights and black power,
exactly.
right?
Yeah.
And how it's so easy to fall back into the grooves of the kind of racist society, even for people who came through the movement because of the way the world is organized, right? And that kind of like, I just think that kind of vulnerability is so refreshing, right? As
mm-hmm.
that is sort of, I'm turning the gaze on me and my world and not just externally. And then you also, but at the same time, You do this thing that I think is rare and very elegant, where you talk about moving through a series of ideas, right, where you confront, you know, whether it's the ISIS papers or post-traumatic slave syndrome or, you know, or sort of moving through a series of ideas as you're trying to figure out, like, what is this race thing? And you leave many of them aside, but you don't do it in a form of attack, right, mm-hmm. of other thinkers. You just say, well, that wasn't right, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to move through. And I find that really refreshing in terms of, like, you know, as intellectuals, you, like, sort of move through a body of ideas. We all have these competing ideas, ways of seeing things, and we're trying to approach the truth. And you get the sense that those were useful for you to go through, even if that's not ultimately where you ended up.
Yeah, man, and I think that ultimately I was trying to figure out what was the problem.
Right.
You know, initially, I think when I graduated high school, I thought that the racial problem was largely black people. And
okay.
I thought also that it was racism, but what was predominant was I thought it was black people.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I, a few weeks into my college life at FAMU in Tallahassee, mm-hmm. Like black folk across Florida experienced the election of 2000, you know, pretty much this voter suppression was ascendant, and pretty much through the election to George W. Bush in the faces of black people,
right?
And those firsthand and secondhand stories of, mm-hmm. of people's votes being spoiled or people being turned away were flooding into FAMU, because FAMU students were representing the entire state. You
absolutely.
Know, you had people from all over the state. So I heard racism, mm-hmm. white racism in particular. And so it was undeniable, right? And it ultimately caused me, I didn't really see it actually as racism at the time. I saw it as white people.
Right.
Because almost all of the people who were engaged in these acts were white.
Right.
And so then I went from, okay, the problem is black people, and to a certain extent racism, to the problem is black people, and to a certain extent racism and white people.
Okay.
And then I was like, okay, what is wrong with white people?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's when I went in search of all of those books, trying to figure out, like, what is wrong with these with these people? Why are they engaged in these types of racist acts? And then ultimately, finally, when I really started engaging in study, particularly through taking courses in African and African American history, mm-hmm. did I begin to see that ultimately the problem was racism.
Right.
And it took me a while really to get to that point.
So I wanna sort of take that up in this question of sort of white people, mm-hmm. right? Because there are some readers who will think you give space to white people to not be categorized as racist. And, you know, there's the whole school of thought where people say, well, all white people are racist because mm-hmm. they're raised in a racist society. So can you talk a little bit about what is it that you're trying to alert white readers to in terms of the possibility? You know, some say, like, their potential in this vision of an anti-racist society. And also, what are you signaling to black and other people of color readers about how to navigate white people in this struggle?
Sure. So I think, as it relates to white people, I mm-hmm. think one of their sort of anthems as it relates to race is, I'm not racist.
Right.
Right. And so obviously I wanted to confront that very
directly,
head on.
Yes.
And say, there's only two options here.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as being not racist.
Right.
There's only being racist and anti-racist.
Mm-hmm.
And also there is a such thing as a racist and an anti-racist.
Yes.
It's not a fixed category, but if you say something that's racist, you're being a racist at that moment. And you have the capacity, though, to change.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you were raised to be racist, and I suspect the vast majority of white people in this country were raised either consciously or unconsciously to be racist.
Right, absolutely.
You still have the capacity to change,
mm-hmm.
to confront your upbringing,
mm-hmm.
to confront what you, in a way, are addicted to, and to be different. But in a way, to be different, to be anti-racist, is going to be a constant struggle.
Yes.
It's almost like a personality characteristic that we decided as adults, we don't want to be that way anymore.
Right.
It's not as if we can wake up one day and be like, okay, I'm no longer,
I'm not
that way anymore.
Yeah.
No, you literally, on a moment by moment, day by day basis, have to constantly self-critique, self-examine, mm-hmm. and strive to be anti-racist. And so that's obviously what I want white people to do, while simultaneously, and I think I talk about this early in the book, obviously, like many other writers, you know, it's critical for them to recognize their privilege mm-hmm. in so many different ways. And I talk about how even poor white people have privilege, right? But then also for them to recognize why so many people of color are angry.
Yes, right.
Are not only angry about racism, but even can show anger towards them, mm-hmm. even when they may not have said or done something that is racist. A white person who is truly anti-racist has an understanding and is empathetic to, let's say, black anger, particularly when it's racialized, because they understand how insidious white racism is. Mm-hmm. They understand how it's very difficult for a person of color to pick out the good anti-racist white person in a crowd of racists.
Sure.
And so when they see that and hear that and feel that, they're empathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's also something I think that's critical in the book.
Absolutely. And I guess relatedly, the feeling I get when I read through your journey is that there's a kind of an ethical mandate, right? Like mm-hmm. when you describe, you know, these questions that you continuously ask yourself, but there's also a mandate for becoming learned, right? So, you know, it as you go through the book and you're reading and you're thinking, you get the feeling, I think, as a reader, oh, right, so I'm supposed to have this disposition where I'm studying and thinking and trying to make sense of this, right? So it's both my deed and my development, right, mm-hmm. in the path to becoming an anti-racist. And one of my favorite parts of the book is when you talk about your time at Temple with two of our mutual friends, Kaila and Yaba.
Yes.
And I love it because you talk about, one, obviously because you bring the questions around sexuality and gender into mm-hmm. talking about being anti-racist, which too infrequently are brought into those conversations. But also, it's one of the multiple places where you talk about the individual encounters that were part of your personal development.
Definitely.
Right? Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know Yaba and Kyla.
Yes.
You know, the way that they are now, mm-hmm. In which they are pretty unapologetic, obviously, about their anti-racism, about their feminism, about their sort of love of queer people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they were the same way then as graduate students at Temple. And I was coming from an experience at FAMU in which I really had never really engaged and understood black feminism.
Mm-hmm.
I really had never even considered and even deeply thought about black queer theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily... I talk even in that chapter about, like, my parents didn't necessarily raise me to be homophobic.
Right.
But they did not certainly raise me to recognize that there was nothing wrong with black queer people.
Right.
And so because of that, in many ways, I consumed many of the ideas about black queer people and certainly about black women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I arrived, like, at Temple was pretty much a homophobic mm-hmm. sexist
mm-hmm.
And didn't even realize it.
Right.
And they allowed me to realize that
mm-hmm.
because they created a community in which certain things were not going to be tolerated.
Right.
Attacks on black women, attacks on black queer people were just not going to be tolerated in their presence.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting is they would... If somebody said something, you know, about particularly those two communities, they wouldn't, like, jump around their throat and just, you know, scream at them. You know, they would, of course, engage them. But I felt those as attacks.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I felt those as attacks, and I had to recognize why I felt those
mm-hmm.
as attacks. Even when they weren't talking to me,
mm-hmm.
they were obviously talking to me.
Right, right.
But what was beautiful was even though I had these homophobic ideas, even though I came there with this sort of gender and queer racism, they sort of opened themselves up to me. mm-hmm. to sort of mentoring me, yeah. to befriending me,
yeah.
which I thought was absolutely sort of critical mm-hmm. in my own personal development. Mm-hmm. And so any sort of gender critique that I have, any sort of critique of homophobia that I have, I owe to those two women.
That's beautiful. I mean, and I think it's beautiful on multiple levels. I mean, one, because you describe the cultivation of a community mm-hmm. that on the one hand, right, doesn't tolerate bigotries, but also didn't expel. Right.
Exactly. And that's a very slippery, yes.
Yeah, yes, it's a and but that's, in some sense, that's what you're suggesting in the entire book. How do we do that, right? How to think about how to do that, to have space for transformation, to work through the moments of feeling defensive and under attack, mm-hmm. right? That's precisely the process, mm-hmm. right, that's essential. And I also think it's really important because it is, you provide in that chapter an example of the combination of the scholarly endeavor, because they're both, you know, extraordinary scholars,
yes.
and the work of community, right? And so often for those of us who are academics, the scholarly endeavor sits off apart from our interpersonal interactions. Yeah. But you're talking about sort of bringing those pieces together. And similarly, you know, you talk about the personal, your personal encounters and some rather difficult ones with illness,
yeah.
right? And I wonder, you know, if we can talk about that, because you part of what you set up is you provide an accounting of all of the effects of racism, including the physical ones, with respect to our health. And then you write about both for you and your wife encounters with serious illness,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, one of the things that happened after STAMP from the beginning, mm-hmm. when I started speaking about it, and, you know, and people started reading it, is people would say to me, like, this book was so difficult for me to read.
Yes.
You know, reading 500 years of people demonizing black people in every way imaginable obviously is very difficult for people who either care about black people or who are black
mm-hmm.
to read. And so they would say, it must have been that much harder to write.
Yeah.
And I would just, you know, it would just go in one ear and out the other,
okay.
just because I didn't want to even think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was sort of so focused when I was doing the research, you know, as you know,
right.
To produce the book.
Yeah.
And I wasn't
mm-hmm.
thinking about the impact that it was having literally. And then combined with the fact that I was writing this history of racist, anti-black racist ideas as a black person. And, you know, the book ended up being 500 pages, but I probably collected thousands and thousands of pages of
mm-hmm.
ideas, and many of which I had to sort of sift through. And in How to Be an Anti-Racist, I talk about these as like trash bags that I literally like had to consume, right,
mm-hmm.
in order to basically make it legible for the reader. And at the time I was doing that, I was also caretaking my wife, who had breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was obviously, you know, she was very young, in her early 30s. And, you know, when you contract a disease, any disease, it's hard. But then when you contract a disease that you don't think you should contract because of your age, you know, it's even more difficult. And so obviously it was a very difficult process, you know, caretaking for her. And I in no way wanted to focus on my own physical health.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, my wife had a serious illness, and so obviously I did not. And then a few years later, I was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And friends asked me, well, do you think that in some ways was the effect of writing STAMP from the beginning, of taking in all of, I mean, they didn't use the term trash bags, but in taking all of that in into the gut, right? And, you know, and I didn't know.
Right.
You know, we'll never know.
Right.
But certainly that could have been the case. And,
mm-hmm.
and I, as you know, I mean, scholars are finding now the literal health effects of racism.
Oh, absolutely. And I, you know, that question of the variety of ways that racism marks us in the body, whether or not there's a kind of direct correlation, right, in the way that we talk about it in the terms of science, mm-hmm. Or a sort of larger environmental phenomenon. So, for example, for you being a scholar who has an enormous public profile and a father and a husband and the director of a center, right, you are serving the world and serving your family in a multiplicity of ways, and even that, right, has mm-hmm. potential costs, right, a sense of calling that has some costs that we can read in part as connected to thinking about, well, what are the consequences of this mission, right? And related to that, I do want to talk a little bit about your work and developing this anti-racism center. And I, you know, was thrilled and honored to be at the book festival that you organized, which I think was, you know, one of the most extraordinary book festivals that I have ever witnessed, and both because you had this fantastic array of speakers, but also a real sense of community and investment and people who were thrilled to be there with you, right, and the space that you had created. So can you talk a little bit about the connection that you see between your work as a writer and scholar and your work as an educator and someone who is cultivating like a think tank of sorts?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, of course, I can never thank you enough for coming and sharing about your incredible biography, of course, of Lorraine. But, I mean, we have envisioned the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center as a space that convenes. I mean, there are so mm-hmm. many writers, for instance, right now, who are writing on racism, yeah. who are trying to sort of get us out of this pit that we've been in for mm-hmm. hundreds of years. And it's, as you know, we typically go to a book festival and there's only a few of us there, right? or, of course, we speak alone, you know, but it's rare that we come together at a festival and share our ideas. Mm-hmm. And so we felt that, okay, what if we convene some of the, you know, most impressive intellectuals and writers, you know, mm-hmm. of our time mm-hmm. each year, who are writing on this topic, and again, that's part of a larger mission to sort of convene and team up specialists to really take a more scientific approach to sort of how we're solving, I should say, how we're examining and solving this racial problem. In other words, we should be building teams of people. Mm-hmm. We should be convening people to ask and answer some of the most intractable racial questions of our time.
Right.
And oftentimes, as you know, we do this in isolation.
Right.
And we know part of the answer, right? And so we're like, okay, what if we bring those different parts together, whether it's, you know, to have those conversations at the National Anti-Racist Book Festival, whether it's research and policy teams that mm-hmm. will literally conduct the research, issue policies, and ultimately design campaigns to change policy, or whether it's literally convening specialists in a field to create policy where it doesn't exist. You know, that's what we're trying to do. And ultimately, to be anti-racist, as you know, is to not just sort of think about and view people as equals. We
right.
literally have to be a part of this movement to change, whether we're changing the narrative, mm-hmm. whether we're changing policy, yeah. or whether we're changing power.
Yeah, and I think that that's absolutely right, and it's so important. And it brings me back to this really powerful point in the book where you're talking about capitalism, mm-hmm. right, and racial capitalism, and the way in which our economic order has been so profound in the United States, so profoundly and intimately tied to the structures of racism. You say, well, if there's a way to redeem capitalism, it's not in place, right? Present, right? And that what you were saying brings me to that because, you know, I'm so used to, and I'm so inclined to talk to you about these like commonplaces and the conversations that we have in Black communities because you provide such an insightful analysis of them. But one of them that you hear all the time is we got to stop doing all this talking and reading and act, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the question that And I always find that troubling because I love Ida B. Wells' statement, the people must know before they can act, right?
Exactly.
And so this work of producing knowledge and imagining policy, and I actually am curious sort of how you think about, or do you think about, like this in terms of stages, right? So, and what I mean is, you know, does the work of being anti-racist have meaning at the level of the individual school? Does it need to be, you know, government policy? Does it need to be revolution? Does it have its, you know what I mean? Those questions, like, does, what do you do with questions of citizenship? Like, how do you imagine the scope for someone, for, we say for, like, one of our freshmen, mm-hmm. right, who comes in like we once did, like wanting to change the world, right? And then realizing, oh, wait, I might not be able to do this by myself, right? But what's the vision for them?
I think it's up to the individual.
Okay.
I think every individual is standing in a different place and space. So mm-hmm. not every individual is like Professor Imani Perry, who is a national and international mm-hmm. figure that can have these sort of national and international sort of conversations mm-hmm. and questions and be at these tables. You have people who their sort of standing in their place is their church.
Mm-hmm.
And there's policies that govern that church.
Absolutely.
There are ideas circulating in that church. And are you a part of the movement in that church to dismantle racist policies,
mm-hmm.
to eject racist ideas from that church? Are you being an anti-racist in that sense? You have people who it's just their sort of local neighborhood. And, you know, their local neighborhood is gentrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And which part of that struggle are you on?
Right.
You have people who just have a home, right? They don't necessarily have time to sort of join an organization because they're working 60 hours a week, but they do raise their children,
right?
And so they can be raising and training their children to be anti-racist.
Mm-hmm.
They can be sending $1 or $2 to an anti-racist organization that's fighting against racist policies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's possible. They're being anti-racist when they do that. And so I think we should all think very clearly about where we are in the world. You know, what places and spaces are we most passionate about? What do we have the capabilities to do? And formulate sort of our action plan, I think, around that.
I find that really powerful and meaningful. And I think particularly because frequently those of us who, you know, the kind of part of the political spectrum which we occupy diminish the individual deed. But given that racism is a product of culture and policy and the repetition of decision making, that the disruption is important, right? Even at the individual level, that you might turn the ship, right?
Yeah.
And that even to imagine a different kind of future, those kinds of disruptions have to take place. So it's not, you have a structural analysis, but you're not a structuralist in the sense of like the end game, mm-hmm. yet, right? It's about how do we move towards something, right?
Yeah.
A way of living.
And
yeah.
I just don't understand how structures are changed if they're not changed by individuals.
Right.
Right. And
absolutely.
So that is really, and not only individuals, but the mobilizing and organizing of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to simultaneously assess and push at the individual and structural level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't understand why we have to, like, because, you know, there's some people just want to look at the individual.
That's
right.
Right.
And just hide the sort of structure
right.
and say, oh,
just
we
matters.
Just need to take personal responsibility
right.
or...
Mm-hmm.
And to me,
that's
flawed in a different type of way.
Right, right. So I think I personally know this from reading your work, but I am interested in asking you, like, who are your, like, if you were to account for your intellectual genealogy, who are the figures that most, as scholars, like, of previous generations, who you see yourself most directly in the tradition of? And that's a question that came out of left field.
Yes.
But I think, because you're a historian and it's all of your work is so deeply grounded in a tradition of thinking through questions, I just can't resist asking that.
So I would say, I mean, as I think now in certain types of ways, you know, I'm seeking to challenge sort of policy in the state.
Yes.
And I think in that type of way, you know, someone as unapologetic as Malcolm
yes.
X,
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously is someone who who I admire in the sense that he's not only apologetically critical of the state, but he also, through his autobiography and even many of his speeches, he's critical about himself.
Yes.
And he's critical of black people
yeah.
when they're sort of being racist. I mean, he didn't mm-hmm. use that sort of term. And then, obviously, in terms of journalism, you know, as an essayist, as a writer for some sort of popular mediums, I'd say Ida B. Wells,
yeah.
Who, you know, as you know, I mean, she literally, like, I wrote today in The Atlantic how she, I can almost feel her staring down a lynch mob.
Yes.
And not moving an
mm-hmm.
inch.
And, mm-hmm.
and in many ways, she wrote that way.
Yes.
Right? And her focus was to sort of write for and to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And a willingness to say and do whatever to sort of challenge white supremacy.
Right, and to tell the truth is right.
Precisely.
Directly.
And not be willing to, not backtracking in any bit. And then I think as a sort of, all of that together, obviously, Du Bois.
Yes.
And the ability to simultaneously be involved in organizations, to be an essayist, to be
mm-hmm.
a scholar. You know, obviously, I think more than any other scholar, I look up
yeah.
to Du Bois. And the irony is, you know, at his time, you know, even personal narrative was something that was utilized,
yes.
particularly by black scholars. And in many ways, we've moved away from that. And I think only
true.
Now we're really
starting
to move back to that.
That's such a good point. And I thought you were going to say Du Bois. And partially because, and I think the Malcolm and Ida B. Wells both make a great deal of sense, but, you know, with Ida B. Wells, the process of discovering the truth,
yeah.
going to the data, right,
exactly.
that ground level work. And I wonder, and I'm thinking about this because you talked about Malcolm, do you see this book as a conversion story?
I do.
Yeah.
yeah. And I see it as, in a way, both confessional and conversion story,
yeah.
that I was constantly confessing and converting
mm-hmm.
to someone new,
mm-hmm.
to someone sort of being more anti-racist.
Yeah. And I think about that in terms of Du Bois as well, because, you know, so often when we teach these historic figures, we teach them as sort of singular at a particular
yes.
point. But, you know, if anybody is an example of moving through,
yeah.
right, a very long life, trying and through personal crisis
yeah.
and tragedy, right, and trying to get closer and closer to the truth and sitting with something for a while, saying, yeah, that's not it. I mean, that's his life, and so
exactly.
you pick up that practice, which I think is sort of the, you know, in the best of our intellectual tradition.
And some of those essays, as you know, that he wrote and speeches he gave in the 1930s and 1940s when
mm-hmm.
he was critiquing himself.
Self, yeah.
Right? I mean, to me, are just some of the most powerful sort of things he ever wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as intellectuals, right, we're supposed to be critical.
Right.
Meaning we're supposed to be critical of
ourselves
too.
As well, right, and fully human.
Exactly.
Right, which I think, I mean, there is, you know, it is interesting because there is that, and you talk about this, right, and you talk beautifully about sort of, in particular when you talk about the process of going to graduate school, right, so we see black studies, it emerges from social movement
mm-hmm.
and this desire to, and yet there's also this pressure to be kind of dispassionate
yeah.
intellectuals. And I think you are a really important example of what we are sort of in the thrall of in this moment is saying, well, one, the absolute objectivity was always a fiction, right? And
yes.
that, in fact, we are called to both be rigorous and our understanding of history and our analysis, but also to be fully human in the midst of that, right? Which means that we have to be fallible, that means we have to be vulnerable, all those
mm-hmm.
sorts of things.
Without question. I mean, I tell the story, as you know, in the book
yeah.
of Amma Mazama, who ultimately came on
yes.
dissertation advisor, and her sort of lecturing on basically there's no such thing as objectivity.
Yes, which I love that moment in the book.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I was trained as a journalist in at FAMU, and I
mm-hmm.
was still thinking, but I was sort of turning towards being a scholar. And of course, journalists hold this idea of objectivity
mm-hmm.
in the way as scholars do, as almost on the throne. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I asked her, okay, so, like, I don't understand. Like, if we can't be objective, then what should we strive to do? And, you know, she's not a woman of many words. And so she looked at me and said, just tell the truth.
Tell the truth. Right. That's right, which is a matter of, like, serious study.
Exactly. And, yeah. And irony is in our moment, right, in 2019.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it resonates that much more. Mm-hmm. How our job as intellectuals, as journalists, as really as human beings, is just tell the truth. Mm-hmm. Even when that truth is self-critical, even when that truth is hard to say.
Yeah.
If we can't find the courage and even the clarity to sort of tell the truth, then I mean, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. What are we doing here?
Mm-hmm. I also want to ask a question about craft. Mm-hmm. Because you know, one of the things about the impact that you've had is about the beauty of your prose, right? And so and you tell stories, like anecdotes, in ways that are riveting, right? You tell these. And, you know, what, for you, what part of this journey to sort of transforming the world is sort of to take up Tony K. Bambara's quote, the job of the writer is to make revolution irresistible. Like, mm-hmm. What part of your work in this regard is, in a sense, about the beauty of the vision and the writing, and the craft? You know?
I think for me, it's, I sort of have begun to distinguish between a public scholar, okay, and public scholarship. And actually,
you do that in the book. Yeah, and that's, yeah, great. Yeah.
And so for me, I view a public scholar as someone who is known by the public. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to be known. I don't want to just be known. I want to produce public scholarship, which I view as scholarship that literally impacts the lives,
yeah,
of the public.
I think it's a really important
thing. And so when you talk about impacting, and in this case, sort of changing how people see the world, changing sort of racial narratives, you have to make the book accessible,
mm-hmm,
right? You have to be able to sort of speak to the people.
Yeah.
You have to present it in a way that people will consume it, right? Especially when you think about what we're at war against, right? And
yeah,
the stories, the ideas that is presented are also riveting, just in a different type of way. Like,
mm-hmm,
this idea of just this massive invasion of people sort of coming to destroy America, and I am your savior. I mean, that's a pretty, you know, for people who think that there's something wrong with Latinx immigrants, it actually, to a certain extent, is riveting. And
that's
this
right.
is what we're up against right now. We're up against these obviously fictional stories,
yes,
that are presented as nonfiction. And I think that's part of the difficulty, right? Oftentimes, racist stories have been fiction. So when you mm-hmm. write fiction, I'd love to write fiction,
right,
because there's no rules.
Right.
You can just
say
whatever.
Right. Yes.
Right. And so in a way, that's what we're up against. We're up against fictional stories.
Yes.
And so when we present an alternative sort of view that's, I would argue, more accurate of the world, we have to produce it at that level. And,
yes,
and so that's really what sort of drives me. And I feel like if I tell a story that doesn't sort of grip people, then I'm to blame.
Mm.
That if I share an idea that people don't understand, I'm to blame.
Yeah.
And so while others would see, like, okay, these people don't understand good storytelling, or, you know, they don't understand this idea. No, I'm always to blame. At least that's how I understand. So then I go back to the drawing board and figure out a new and more effective way to tell that story or to share that idea.
Yeah. So there's clarity, there's truth, and there's also beauty,
yeah,
right, that are all working simultaneously. Final question. What, although I could talk to you forever, what are your hopes for this book? And it's very clear to me that your hope and your vision is not a selfish one, right? And I appreciate that, because there's a lot of pressure to be selfishly motivated in this world, right? That your hopes are about sort of what you want to give to the world. But what are your hopes for what this book will do? What, and for the readers, where you want them to go from here?
So I think for individuals, I mean, some of the best responses that people have said to me is when they've said something like, this book is liberating. In the sense that it allows them to no longer be confined by racist ideas, by this desire, for instance, as a black person to like represent the race well, this belief that because of what they've said and done in the past, that they can't be anti-racist tomorrow. And so, you know, I'm hoping that in a way sort of removes those shackles, those conceptual and even those shackles that allows people to really understand themselves and all their complexities, to strive to be anti-racist. And then ultimately, I hope that this book helps with the work of other scholars like yourself to really build a movement, right? A social movement, a powerful movement, and powerful people who are ultimately going to dismantle racism and white supremacy.
I have the same hope. Thank you, Ibram.
Thank you so much, Iman.